San Diego's talk radio leader, 760 KFMB presents It's Your Money and Your Life. For the next hour, Richard Muzio and Joe Vecchio will educate and inform you on matters related to your financial future, your life, and your leisure. Now, with It's Your Money and Your Life, here are Richard and Joe.
All right, everybody, my name is Joe Vecchio, your co-host, announcer, and producer, coming to you from KFMB Studios with 50,000 watts of power. We're heard not just in San Diego County, but Orange County, LA County, up the coast of Seattle on a good night, down to Cabo, out to the desert. If you download the app for 760 KFMB, you can hear us on any device live. All these podcasts are commercial-free on iowamoney.com, and we also stream at 760kfmb.com. And now time to introduce the main man of the hour. He's a CPA extraordinaire. He's an accomplished marathon runner. He's a best-selling author, a philanthropist, and a family office expert. Advising several high net worth families. His name is Richard Muzio. Richard, good evening. How are you tonight?
I am doing great, Joe.
Yeah, boy, last week's show.
Yeah, that was really something.
Typically, I like to have a few laughs during the show, but boy, that was kind of a heart-rending show. But
did you get through the book?
I did, and I didn't want to read. I read her epilogue, Dr. Kalanithi's epilogue, over the weekend because I knew if I read it before, I probably couldn't get through the show without a box of Kleenex. But it is really, there's three quotes in there. I mean, she's, I don't know if you guys know, the number one bestseller on the New York Times list, by the way. But it's a memoir about her husband, who was a doctor, who in his last 2 years of his life wrote this book, and he passed it. Matter of fact, tomorrow's 1 year anniversary since
he passed away at the age of 37.
Yeah.
So you said there were three quotes?
Well, yeah. I mean, when she said, thank you for loving me. I mean, oh, my God. I mean, I remember that movie, Love. I mean, I cried. I mean, you must have cried when you read that, right?
I read the book about 2 days before we did the show.
Yeah, it's something else. But
just to have time to recover.
But best wishes to her and family. I'm sure you must have sent her the podcast and everything, right? And,
well, I was going to wait until after the 9th.
Yeah. Okay, that's a good idea. But on a more positive note, I was invited to the opening of the new Fireside restaurant. As you recall, Richard, we had the owner of the patio, Gina Champion Kane. She had the two great places, the one in PB and then the one in Mission Hills.
Right.
And just embarked on this new place, Fireside at Liberty Station. You enter Liberty Station where Corvette Diner is on the Lytton Street entrance, and it is just beyond that. Man, what a cool place. And I had a pork chop, which unlike I've never seen before. I felt like Fred Flintstone or something, but it really was delicious. So check it out, folks. And it's spacious, too. It's a lot more roomy than the other two. It's 7,000 square feet. But we should not digress too long because we have two guests in studio tonight. And I don't know how many folks have heard about the Independent Voter Project, but they do get millions in their web traffic, and they have tons of followers. And we have the founder and, Chad Peace. I'll just get right to it. Chad Peace is the co-founder. Or maybe the founder, and then also Jeff Marston, former assemblyman who works over there as well. But anyway, I want to welcome to the show Chad Peace. Chad, how are you?
I'm very good. Thanks for having me.
Outstanding. Well, before we get into your enterprise here, maybe you tell us a little bit about your background. I know your dad is Steve Peace, and most people would know that, I would think. So, you were born and raised, obviously, you're a native of San Diego, right?
Yeah, so my involvement in this, I guess, depends on how far you want to go back.
Well, born and raised, what part of town were you born and raised? Where'd you go to high school, college, and then all that other good stuff? And then we'll get into how you launched into this. So,
all right, I was born and raised in El Cajon, went to Valhalla High School.
Nice.
Native San Diegan.
I'm El Capitan, just so you know.
All right, fellow East Countian. Mm-hmm. All right, so born and raised here. I went to college at UCLA, came back to San Diego, went to law school at USD, and found it hard to leave San Diego like a lot of people.
Wow, what'd you major in at UCLA?
Economics and philosophy.
Wow, that's great. And then you had an inkling to be a trial attorney, or you wanted to get a law degree and then think about it from there, or what?
You know, I never went into law school thinking, I want to be an attorney. It was more, I want to know what an attorney does and have a degree that an attorney has.
Wow.
And I had a special interest in elections and politics and how it works. So I took my time there. I took every law of democracy class.
Well, you probably got more out of it than most students because you were really in there to absorb the knowledge. Did they have a class in election law when you went there?
They did, actually. Assemblyman Brian Mainshine taught an election law class. I took that class. It was awesome. He did a great job. Had a little shout out for Brian.
He's a former assemblyman.
He's still in the assembly.
He is.
He's a sitting assembly member, and took law of democracy, some other classes, and I was the president of our international arbitration team.
Huh? How about that? Interesting. So, what year did you graduate there?
I think it was 2012.
Okay, 2012, and then you I guess wanted to get into the election law career type thing. So what gave you the inspiration to launch IVP, Independent Voter Project?
Well, actually, IVP, Independent Voter Project, was started in 2006 by, full disclosure, my father, Steve Peace, and Jeff Marston, who's sitting here to my left, so a Republican and a Democrat. And their mission was to, well, their slogan is, democracy functions best when the most people participate. So I actually got involved in law school not because I had a legal degree and I was an attorney, because I was obviously still in law school. They asked me because me and my former and current business partner had experience in the digital media world. And so their question for us wasn't, can you help us on the legal end? It was, hey, we have an idea of trying to reform the election process. Can you help us educate voters?
Interesting. So what were you doing in the digital media world before this then?
So, like I said, every story depends on how far you go back. After having grown up in a political world, I concluded I didn't want to be involved in politics. But then, around 2006, 2007, me and my former and current business partner were very engaged in that Ron Paul revolution. And we together helped organize and help promote. You know, a lot of people like to take credit for things, especially those big money bombs Ron Paul had. But there was a lot of people across the country, and we happened to be a couple of them that were working in the inner grassroots circles to promote those. So
to build that network up a little bit.
Right. So as a consequence, we learned a lot about the value of using digital media to reach voters. Subsequently went back to law school, probably moderated my positions a little bit, came a little bit less ideological and a little more practical about not only what the solutions are, but really thinking about, well, where do the grievances really lie in the election process.
I thought we were going to get to, full disclosures, Chad's dad was one of the principals involved in Attack of the Killer Tomatoes, a famous cult film. And actually, there was a part two, a sequel, and then is there a third one coming out?
Well, there's actually four. There's actually four that were produced for better or for worse. But there's escalating rumors that a script is being written for a rewrite of the original, and it's getting closer to its finalizing the script, and then see about how quickly we can get into production.
How can you possibly top the original?
Well, I don't know.
Well, that's possible. Richard, I actually was an extra, I think, in the sequel.
You were an extra tomato?
No. They were filming this. I think there's a hotel now. It was the San Diego Bank and Trust down on Broadway. They were filming one scene down. You remember this, Jeff? And you know who was in it? Was Rick Rockwell.
Yeah, Rick Rockwell.
I knew at the time.
Yeah.
He roped me into this thing, and then John Astin, is it, or who's the guy from the Addams Family?
He
was in it, and then this Olympic swimmer guy, I forget his name, but he was in it, and you probably remember the maybe not. Anyway, I think I got left on the cutting room floor, but we did all go to the premieres and everything, and actually it's a pretty famous film. Does it sell well globally? Or
it did pretty well. It actually had a very very large international following, especially in Japan, and actually Spain for some reason had a really big following. I mean, some people say it can't get any better. Some people say it couldn't possibly get any worse.
Attack of the Killer Tomatoes.
Hey, just the title alone.
I know. I think that's anyway. That's interesting. I thought you were going to tell me my digital experience. I helped to promote the tomatoes franchise online, but anyway, I digress. But that's an interesting little side note for listeners, I think. But anyway, where did we leave off? So you went back to law school. You went to law school, and then what gave you the inspiration? I guess this started, and then you started working over at IVP yourself?
Right. So IVP contacted us and said, hey, can you help us with voter outreach, voter education online? So as I started building tools. One of them was a news website and Facebook page to educate voters about how the election process really works. So while I was doing that, I was also taking classes like Law of Democracy and Election Law, and really trying to think about how does our election laws affect the individual rights of voters? So let's stop looking at voters as a group of Democrats. Mm-hmm. Let's stop looking at them as a group of Republicans or Libertarians.
Yeah.
Let's and just look at voters as individual people.
And the traffic now is what? How many a day or week or month or whatever?
Well, like our Facebook reach, for example, is about 6 million a month.
Isn't that
organically.
Something?
Wow.
All right, so more about IVP with Chad Peace when we come back. Hang on. We're back with
Attack
Chad Peace.
Good job, Justin.
That's Justin on the soundboard doing a little research during the break. Good for you. Anyway, I forgot that I have to buy that soundtrack, but I didn't know they had a soundtrack.
I can get you a deal.
All right, who sang that? Anybody know who sang that? Anybody know? Who knows?
I don't look at me. I don't know.
Your dad, maybe.
You don't want to hear him sing.
Anyway, independentvoterproject.org. You get in there. The traffic now is phenomenal. You say 6 million on Facebook, and just tell me to the website per se.
Are you about 500,000 views a month?
Isn't that something? My gosh. I know he's a major four, and they're not all in California, right? This is
no, it's national. We target some of our outreach in California, but it's a national-based audience.
So
what are the demographics of the viewers? Is it a younger crowd, or is it all across the board?
Yeah, it might surprise you that the average Facebook follower on our like on our Facebook page is actually over 55 years old.
Wow.
I was going to say 45. Wow.
Okay.
That is something.
That does surprise me.
Well, a lot of people don't know this, but and you can bear this out, Chad. The largest group voting block of voters out there is the independent voter. It's 43% nationally. It's at an all-time high. Isn't that right?
Right. And yeah, if you look, and a lot of political commentators will try to identify political independents as, you know, they're really left leaning or right leaning or this or that. The reality is you can't put a label on an independent voter.
Right.
By definition, they're independent minded. And
right.
Sure, some of them are on the far left, some are on the far right. But what we try to focus on them is not as a collective group, but as an individual voter. And so that's how we approach voting rights in the election process.
I consider myself a meritocrat. If the candidate merits my vote, I will vote for him or her. And I don't like to get, you know, labeled. And I think a lot of people are starting to feel that way. Huh?
Well, it's tough being both a Democrat or a Republican these days, Joe.
Well,
that's why it's 43%.
Well, I don't know.
Who are not.
Well, Democrats, I think it's about 35, and I think Republican about 25, plus or minus a point or two. Is that about right, would you say, registration-wise nationally?
Right, by registration. So you think, and look at the primary elections in this presidential cycle, a lot of folks have registered with a party simply so they can cast a vote during the primary election. So if you go by self-identification, the number is actually a lot higher in political independence.
Well, I'm in favor of open primaries, and I don't know how many states have those anymore. I mean, do we have that in California across the board locally and throughout the state? Or do you have to, if you wanted to vote for Trump, you had to register as Republican? How does that work?
Right, well, it's a little bit complex because in California we have different system for president and for statewide elections.
Okay.
Now there's a long historical context to this, but Independent Voter Project in 2010 authored an initiative, the top two nonpartisan primary.
Mm-hmm.
And what that did, there's all kinds of people who commentate on what it was supposed to do or not do, but think about it from an individual rights perspective, it's really simple.
Mm-hmm.
Traditional primaries, the purpose is a private purpose. It's to elect somebody to represent the party on the general election ballot.
Mm-hmm.
What the top two did was change the purpose to a public purpose. And we said, if the taxpayers are going to fund a system, if our public officials are going to administer it, the purpose shouldn't be to elect somebody to represent the party on the general election ballot. It should be the top two candidates that represent the entire electorate. So now all the candidates, all the voters, they all participate on one ballot. Now that didn't change the presidential primary because we have to fit our presidential primary within a system that serves 50 different states who all send their electors to the Electoral College. So ironically, California has an open presidential primary under their constitution, but because of arguments made by the Democratic Party in 2000 before the Supreme Court, our state is not allowed to force the parties to allow non-members to participate in their primaries. So I said it's ironic because under today's rules...
Which Supreme Court, California or U.S.?
The United States Supreme Court.
Oh, okay.
So I called it ironic because we, the Democrats, allow non-members to participate on their presidential primary now in California, where they're the same party that argued before the Supreme Court that said you can't force us to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So, but the Republicans, they closed their presidential primary. So if you want to vote for Trump or Cruz or Kasich and you're not a Republican, well, then you can't.
Are you guys working to try to overcome that or open all that up? Because I think that's a good idea, don't you?
We've actually have a resolution right now. It's in the California legislature, which would is a balance between the two rights at stake. And now the Independent Voter Project is not anti-party. And mm-hmm. we recognize the parties have a legitimate right to protect their nomination process. Mm-hmm. So our resolution before the in the assembly right now is relatively simple. It says, okay, you're going to issue a ballot that serves the private purpose of the Democratic Party and the private purpose of the Republican Party. But for all those voters who choose not to identify with the political party, simply put all the candidates on the ballot and let them select from any of the candidates. And the parties can choose to view those results and consider them at their state conventions, or they can choose not to. But as it stands right now, the delegates are actually selected by the parties at their state convention.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you go to the Democratic Party's private rules, for example, they have no obligation to follow the results of the primary election.
Right.
And ironically, the Republican Party actually binds themselves to the primary election results.
Well, there's pledged delegates and there's superdelegates, right? So the pledged ones must, how does that work?
Well, that's actually post-primary,
okay.
Right? So even before that, when they have the vote, the actual selection process is made at the convention. So some might say the Democratic Party is more democratic because they allow all voters to participate in their primary. Some people might argue that the Republican Party is actually more democratic because at their state convention, they have private rules
that say the winner takes all kind of thing.
Well, it
right?
says we have to follow the will of the Republican voters that mm-hmm. participated in the primaries.
But didn't that happen in, I guess, 2008? Didn't Hillary have most of the superdelegates, and didn't they all change over to Obama when they saw how the states were going over time, or how did?
Right. Well, the superdelegates issue is a lot more complex, and it's more governed by internal party rules. But yeah, the superdelegates are essentially free to select who they want. They don't right. have to follow the will of the public election at all.
And how often do they deviate from that? I mean, it's typically. I mean, and obviously President Obama got elected. He must have won most of the superdelegates. And even though they may have, you know, announced for someone else earlier on, is that how it worked out? I didn't really follow it that closely in 2008.
Well, I think the superdelegates are really just, they're more of an internal party kind of battle mm-hmm. for them. And if they see the will of the voters going one way or another, they're mm-hmm. likely to switch their position.
The sad thing is, it comes down to about, I think there's like, Politico says there's 7 battleground states in this election cycle, Nevada, mm-hmm. New Hampshire, a few others. I mean, so those states essentially are electing the president, right?
That's right.
You know,
so, Chad, who's going to be the next president?
Well, Richard, come on now, come on.
I certainly don't have that answer.
They don't have dogs in this fight. They're independent, and they're not part of
all the research.
But my point is, you know, 7 swing states determine the president, and, you know, maybe it's time to get rid of the Electoral College, too. What do you think?
Well, I think you asked a fundamental question. When California State sends their electors to the Electoral College, to whose loyalty do they have them? And as it stands now, we've basically ceded our authority to send delegates to the Electoral College to the Democratic Party. That's what the state's done. And so our position has always been that elections should serve voters first. And it's not in California's interest. It's not in the California Democratic Party's interest or the California Republican Party's interest to put ourselves, our state, in a position where we literally don't matter.
Yeah.
Where candidates don't come to our state and talk to our voters because...
And our primary's in June. It's
right.
so late. It's after
well, it's
everybody.
Late.
And it's directly related to the election process that ceded our authority over
so,
to...
So maybe we need to move that up a few months, too. What do you say? And who's after June? I don't even know. I mean, that's pretty much the ball game by June. You pretty much know who's going to be in it, right?
Usually the primaries usually...
Well, that'll
determined
be another,
almost by
so
today.
So that's another project for us, guys. Let's get that,
lots
let's
of work
move that primary
Chad, do you think
up,
the party so. System will look the same 100 years from now as it does today? Or do you think there's going to be significant changes over time?
It probably won't look the same in 20 years, Richard. It's not looking the same right now. The Republican Party's imploding.
Well, but I asked Chad. You know,
yeah, I know. Well, but I know, but we got a half a minute to get to the break.
I think it has to change. I mean, when the parties, when they instituted primaries at the turn of the century, we had a much different demographic. Half the voters were Republicans, mm-hmm. half were Democrats, and now
remember
we have
the Dixiecrats? I mean, the Democrat was mostly a Southern party back in the day.
Right. And like I said, we're not about ending the parties or even ending the two-party system. I think what we have to do is reframe election laws so that it encourages participation.
Mm-hmm. Well, the 43% Indies, I mean, they are ripe for a third-party person. But anyway, independentvoterproject.org, folks, get over there. We'll be back with Jeff Marston after this break. Hang on.